We'll call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order, the hour of 10:15 having arrived. We do not have a quorum at this point. We do have, however, two very distinguished presenters today. We have Dr. Paul Wilson from the Department of Revenue and Professor John Spry, the University of St. Thomas. And do we have our technical difficulties worked out, Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, I can start. If people have the handout, I can start.
Okay.
Computer just decided to shut down on me, and I've got to restart it. It takes a while.
We have the handout. Okay, members, we should have the handout. Is it the tax incidence analysis? Oh, okay, that's not the one. Members, it should be 2011 Minnesota State and Local Tax Incidence Presentation. So we will use the one that we have here. So, Dr. Wilson, if you could please start with your presentation, and when we do have a quorum, Dr. Wilson, I will be rudely interrupting you to take care of a few minor details, some housekeeping issues, and then we'll get back to you. So, members, I would prefer that we listen to Dr. Wilson's presentation, then I'd like to go to Professor Spry, and then Dr. Wilson for a few comments, and then we will open it up to questions from committee members at that time. So I'd like to have Dr. Wilson make his entire presentation, then we'll go to Professor Spry, as I said, and then back to Dr. Wilson, and then questions from members. Dr. Wilson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Wilson. I'm the Director of Tax Research Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'm pleased to be here today to present the tax incidence study. This is the 2011 Minnesota State and Local Tax Incidence Study. I know there are some new people on the committee. Some of you know a lot about this study. Some of you know less. So I hope I don't bore those of you who have been through this before. But I do want to give an overview of the report, and then I'll let Professor Spry respond to really discuss criticisms about the report. The history of the report, if you have the slide, I'm going to go down to slide two, and when I get on the screen, I'll move to that. But the history of the report, this is a mandated, legislatively mandated report. And the question that is asked in this report is, who pays Minnesota state and local taxes? The study was mandated back in the 1980s. This is the 11th biennial study. That means that there were four of these studies done during Governor Carlson's administration, two during Governor Ventura's, four during Governor Plenty's administration, and this is the first during Governor Dayton's administration. This is not a document prepared for Governor Dayton, despite some of the press attacks that claim that that's what this is. So it's a long history of this report in the past. We have made a lot of modifications through the years. We added business taxes in the second report. We now have five-year projections. We've added income deciles as well as population deciles, added the income deciles really at the request of the Senate Tax Committee. We've added more demographic detail in response to questions, and we have a lot more information in Appendix C on individual taxes. And we've done all this without legislative mandates to make those changes. I know that you have a bill to mandate a change on us, and we are certainly willing to talk about making some changes without the mandate if that is, because we've done that in the history of this report before. We've made changes as desired by committees without mandates, but we'll leave that there. If you turn to slide three, the outline of what I want to do, I'm going to talk about the strengths of the report briefly. And I just list the strengths there. It looks at Minnesota state and local tax system as a whole. One of the problems we get into, and you have when you begin looking at tax structure, is a tendency to look at it tax by tax. And so this looks at the entire structure of the state and local tax system rather than just individual taxes one at a time. The second strength is it includes business taxes as well as taxes on individuals. The third is it includes all Minnesota households, or at least it represents all Minnesota households, including non-filers. So you've got the whole population included in the database or represented in the database. Fourth, it uses a broad definition of income, a measure of income that I think is common sense definition of income for people who are looking at tax, at the definition of tax policy. And fifth, it gives us historical perspective. We have fairly comparable results going back to 1990, so that The advantage of having a report that's repeated multiple times is that you can look at the history and ask what's happened through time. I then will give a brief summary of results of the study for 2008. And then I want to talk a little bit about sources of confusion. One source of confusion is that the average income in this report is a lot lower than the average income reported in the census for households. So the first question would be, why is the average income in the instance study so much lower than the census? This has caused a lot of people sort of saying this can't be true. You got to be making a mistake. The income is too low. The second thing I want to talk about is household variations. Basically, we have all households lumped together, single people, married couples, and that is sort of a comparison of apples and oranges when you put them together, and so how do we deal with that in the report? Third, on business taxes, I just want to give a warning about one of the problems with doing incidence of business taxes, and it's a difference between our report and what happens if you change business taxes. Incremental incidence is different than average incidence in the report. We do give results for 2008 and projections to 2013, and sometimes it's a question of which one should I use. And if there's time, and there probably won't be, I have slides in here about income deciles versus population deciles, but that's not been a big issue this in the debate or the discussion of the public at this point. The strengths of the study. First of all, it includes all Minnesota state and local taxes. Doesn't include only state taxes. The system that you...
Dr. Wilson... Sorry to rudely interrupt you, but we do have a quorum, so we'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Wardlow moves the minutes of April 26, 2011. Any questions, corrections, or additions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And I just have a very brief announcement here. Susie Murthen, one of the tax pages, has left us. I said last night, we'll see you in the morning. She said, no, you won't. And I said, okay. I said, and she announced that she has been hired by the DFL caucus on second floor, I believe. So our committee's loss is the second floor's gain. And so we're very happy for her that she was able to do that. So we have today with us Megan Butte, and she would be really lucky if she was assigned to the tax committee, but if she's not, I don't know for sure who the new, it would be her lucky day. So I don't know who the committee page will be, but that'll be announced shortly, and we'll certainly let everyone know who the new committee page is. So we're very happy for Susie, and so she's going to the second floor. Dr. Wilson, please continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, the first strength I want to mention is just that it includes all Minnesota state and local taxes, not just the income tax, not just the property tax on homes. And there is an advantage to being able to look at the entire system. This includes all the taxes over which you have jurisdiction. So it includes property taxes as well as state taxes. Secondly, it includes business taxes. And there is some confusion about what we mean by a business tax. There is discussion of this in the report. I've listed here the business taxes as we define them. We follow largely the definition used in studies by Ernst & Young and by funds are paid for by cost. But a business tax is not just a tax that's paid initially by business, but it's a tax that essentially could be borne by business. So the sales tax on consumer purchases, while it's collected by business, we don't consider that part of the sales tax to be a business tax. So it's not the administrative side of this. It's sort of the economic reality of it. Is this a tax on business? Interesting thing, if you look at business taxes, they represent at the bottom of the slide 32.3% of total tax collections in Minnesota in 2013. So a third of the taxes are what we refer to as business taxes. The largest group of that is business property taxes, which is half of all business taxes. The sales tax on business inputs is another 30% of all business taxes. It is worth pointing out the corporate tax is only 9% of total business taxes, total state and local business taxes in Minnesota in that year. Again, motor fuels tax on fuels used by business is a business tax. If it's a motor fuels tax on purchases by us to fill gas, put gas in our cars, that's a consumer tax or an individual tax. So the business taxes are the more complicated analysis we have. That's a third of the base. The next page just gives you a list of the individual taxes as well, which is the other two-thirds of the total taxes. And when we do business tax incidents, there's a long discussion in the report, pages 87 to 99, of how we do this. And I'm not going to go through the methodology for business taxes, but if you have an interest in the methodology and how we come up with our results, I really urge you, there is no shortcut to sort of walking through this. We use a standard economic model for figuring out, because we have to estimate how much of each tax is shifted forward to consumers in higher prices, how much is shifted back to workers in lower wages, and how much is borne by owners in lower profits. And that analysis that's going to vary by industry, because if you're in different markets, you may not be able to raise prices in some markets, you may be able to in others. And we also are looking at this in the long run. In incidence analysis assumes that businesses have had time to adjust to these taxes, and so it's a long-run analysis, not sort of what happens in the first year. We also do estimate how much of our Minnesota state and local tax burden is exported to people in other states, and the estimate is about 16%, much higher share of business taxes than individual taxes. The third strength is it's not limited to income tax filers. 11.5% of households don't file an income tax return. 7.5% don't file either a PTR return or an income tax return, and many of these are seniors. And in a lot of the analysis that's done, these people are just left out. The income tax runs, the HITS model runs on income tax do not include these people. They're just not there. This is the one place we have the entire population there. The sample includes detailed income and tax information on about 105,000 households, which are then blown up to represent the entire population. We have hard data on a few things. The income numbers are sort of hard numbers. Actual numbers, the income tax we know, the homeowner property tax we know, the PTR amounts we know, motor vehicle registration tax we know. Most of the other taxes have to be estimated, and that process is fairly complicated in terms of estimating not just the business tax burden, but the sales tax burden, because we don't have any way of knowing exactly how much somebody pays in sales taxes. The sample of 105,000 households is weighted to represent 2.54 million households in the state, and then we divide them into 10 groups, 10 equal groups of 254,000 in each group. And we refer to we rank them by income from lowest income to highest income. The poorest 10,000, the poorest 10% or 254,000 is the first decile, and they have incomes less than 9,795. The richest 10%, the highest income 10%, are in the 10th decile with incomes over $129,567. These are 2008 numbers. And so that's what the decile means. Decile is just simply a tenth of the population. We refer to them as population deciles. They're actually household deciles because it's not the same number of people in each decile, but the same number of households. The fourth advantage is it uses a broad measure of income. Now, this is advantage and disadvantage in some ways. That's a broad measure of income. We start with federal gross income on your income tax return, and notice that that may be negative. So we have people with negative incomes in this sample. And those people with negative incomes are in the first decile, which causes some havoc with our numbers. But we add to that a lot of non-taxable income, non-taxable Social Security income, pension income, non-taxable interest, workers' compensation cash payments, welfare payments, voluntary contributions to deferred comp, which don't show up on your tax return. In other words, it's a fairly broad definition of money, sort of cash income. It does not include in-kind things like food stamps, housing assistance, fringe benefits, and it also doesn't include pre-tax payments for health insurance or medical care because it's difficult to get an even playing field between those with employers paying and those not, so we just leave it out for everybody. So what do the results show? This is the graph that everyone refers to, okay? I mean, this report is not a soundbite. This is too thick to be a soundbite, okay? But this is the soundbite, okay? This is what people look at. This is population deciles. So from the left-hand side, we've got the poorest 10%, lowest income 10%. The top 10% is the 10th decile. And this is the effective tax rate by decile. The effective tax rate is simply total taxes, total tax burden, divided by total income. For the whole population of Minnesota, if you take the total tax burden and you divide by the total income for everybody, all Minnesotans, the average is 11.5%. So on average, people are paying 11.5% of their income, as defined in this study, Minnesota state and local taxes. These are Minnesota residents paying 11.5% of their income on Minnesota state and local taxes. Effective tax rate varies, though. It's extremely high in the first decile, and I'll say a bit in the next slide. It's fairly smooth after that. It does dip in the 10th decile noticeably from 11.7 to 10.3%. So the 10th decile is those with over about $130,000 of income. The graph also shows the top five and the top one. Now, the top five are in the top 10, and the top one is in the top five, so these are not exclusive groups, but rather just different ways of slicing the top 10%. Notice on here that everybody, as we're in Minnesota, and as Lake Wobegon always seems to show, almost everyone is above average. Everyone is above average except the 10th decile. The 10th decile is 10.3%, which is less than 11.5%, which is the average overall. Everybody else is above average. And so a lot of the talk about the 10th decile is just simply that, suggesting that the 10th decile is paying lower effective tax rates as a percent of their income than the other nine deciles in the study. Should be mentioned that, you know, how does the 10th decile pay less as a percent of their income? Well, they have 42% of their income, of the total income. 42% of the total income is in the top 10% of households. So they have 42% of the income, they pay 38% of the tax. So they're paying a smaller share of the tax than they have as a share of their income, which is why their effective tax rate is lower than average. And so they are paying a very large portion of the tax, 38% of the tax, but it's a smaller portion of the tax than of the income in the state, and that's why you get the drop in that top decile. The first decile problem is a serious one, 32.5% effective tax rate. The tax burden is overestimated for a number of reasons. We always say don't look at the first decile. We'd like to throw it out, but I don't think our mandate in the study actually, the statutory language doesn't let us take it out as far as I can tell. The tax burden is overestimated for several reasons. Most importantly, some people have temporarily low incomes. If you have business losses, you may have negative incomes. You're in the first decile. And this was pointed out because a number of you pointed out in a hearing not long ago that a number of people in the first decile have million-dollar homes. And you want to say, how is that possible? Well, 12,500 of those people in the first decile, 5% of the first decile, have negative incomes averaging 120,000 negative. The fact that 400 of those 12,500 have million-dollar houses is not all that surprising. Those 400 have business losses of averaging $600,000 each. Those are not poor people. Okay, those are wealthy people to a large extent who have negative incomes, maybe for 1 year, maybe repeated years if they are investing in various kinds of tax shelter activity where they may have losses year after year. But at least they're not what we think about as someone with less than $10,000 of income. So we don't know quite what the best way is to handle that. We may want to just take them out and show them as a separate line and say the rest of the first decile. It's not quite clear how to deal with business losses, but that explains a lot of the reason why we're giving these people a lot of business tax burden because they have a lot of business assets, but they have negative incomes. And so you get extremely high effective tax rates. And we just say don't pay attention to the first decile. Just ignore it. It is misleading as an indicator, certainly, of fairness issues because of those people being there. We talk a lot about progressive, regressive, proportional taxes. A progressive tax is just simply one where the effective tax rate, the tax as a percent of income, goes up as income goes up. A regressive tax is one where the effective tax rate, tax as a percent of income, goes down as income goes up. And a proportional one is one where it just is the same for everybody. And if you go back to slide 11, you know, it looked pretty flat from 2 through 8, from 2 through 9, it looks pretty flat. If you get rid of the first decile and the top decile, you have pretty much a flat line there. So the regressivity comes partly from the first decile, although that's a very small impact on the regressive measures. Most of it comes from the 10th decile, the drop in the 10th decile. If this were a proportional tax, it would be horizontal, perfectly horizontal. If it were regressive, it would be downward sloping. If regressive taxes, it would be upward sloping with the effective tax rate rising with income. Now, we measure regressivity because nothing is ever either upward sloping or downward sloping. It's always mixed. We use something called the Suits Index. It's just a simple measure, summary measure of regressivity that sort of says even if things bump around a little bit, we got one measure we can use. It's used a lot. It's actually mandated in statute that we report a Suits Index or something like it, by the way. So the Suits Index is actually mentioned in the mandate for this study. But it's a number between minus 1 and plus 1. Minus 1 would be one taxpayer paying all the tax at the bottom, the poorest taxpayer paying all the tax. Plus 1 would be the richest taxpayer paying all the tax. 0 is proportional. In this study, in 2008, the Suits Index is minus 0.06. Now, you may say that's very close to 0, but actually that's, you know, if you think about tax policy, it would take a lot of tax policy to get that back to 0. as you've seen. The Dayton tax proposal does not get it back to zero. Okay, it gets it down to minus 0.025 in our estimate. So it takes a lot of tax policy to get this to zero, even though it looks like a small difference from zero. How do we get there? If we just look on the next slide, 14, this is a stacking graph, and you've got the final report, but I can stack them one at a time here. So here's the income tax. Okay. The income tax is our only progressive tax. It's 35, if you look at the box, 35% of the tax burden is from the income tax on Minnesotans, is from the Minnesota income tax. It has a Suits Index of plus 0.218, which is fairly progressive. It's the only major tax which is progressive. And if it's negative because of refundable tax credits at the bottom, and it keeps going up continuously with income, it's a progressive tax. If you add next, the next least progressive, which is residential property tax after PTR, if you didn't put the PTR in here, this would actually be about like the sales tax. But 21% of the tax burden comes from residential property tax after PTR, homes and rent and rental housing, at suits of 0.159, and another 10% comes from non-residential property taxes, business property taxes, but not rental housing, which is included in the residential property tax. And finally, sales tax is 22% of the total state and local sales tax, with a negative suits index, which is larger in the negative direction than the income taxes in the positive direction. And then the all other includes excise taxes and a bunch of others, which are very regressive in their burden, which, of course, some sort of the cigarette tax, gambling taxes, et cetera. Although this includes other taxes like corporate insurance premiums, everything is in here that isn't mentioned earlier. So when you look at it that way, you've got the income tax, which is very progressive. It's offsetting a lot of regressive taxes and coming out fairly close to level but one is offsetting the other. And we often think about this as simply the income tax offsetting the regressivity of the other taxes. There are a couple of slides in the packet that may be worth looking at. Slide 15 just shows the impact of those refundable credits on the income tax alone. This is just the income tax. The blue line is the income tax, what the income tax would look like. These are effective tax rates by decile again, same kind of a graph. It's upward sloping, it's highly progressive, even without the earned income credit, dependent care credit, and K-12 credit. But those credits bring this down negative for the first two deciles and make the income tax substantially more progressive as a result. In addition, the PTR has a major impact on the regressivity of residential property taxes. Without the PTR, the property tax would be about as progressive as the sales tax. With the PTR, it's considerably less progressive. The red line is here with the PTR. It's upward sloping between the second and the sixth decile and pretty much the eighth decile, so that within a wide range, the property tax, the PTR makes the property tax progressive, although it does dip out down at the top, which makes it regressive overall. But you can see the big difference. If you had neither the refundable tax credits nor the PTR, the Suits Index, instead of being minus 0.06, would be minus 0.082. So it makes a 0.022 change, which is pretty big, but again, that shows you how big minus 0.06 is when it takes all of that to change it by minus 0.022. So the minus 0.06 is a fairly large number, even though it sounds small. Sources of confusion, and Chair, Mr. Chair, I can speed up. I mean, you can give me some notice here. I'll keep going.
Keep going. You're doing a great job.
Sources of confusion. Why does the household definition differ so much from the census? I remember a member in committee once saying the census says the average family income is like $80,000 and you've got an income of $30,000 or something in there as your median. I said, they can't be right. And I said, first, I was a little bit taken back because I hadn't made the comparison directly, but the census does give a median household income, and the median household income in the study in the census is about $57,000. And yet we're showing a median income in the study of $41,000. Where'd all the money go? Well, it's not a difference so much in the definition of income. In fact, we include a little more income than the census does. It's really a difference in the definition of a household. The census says if three single people are living together in one residential unit, that's a household. And they will combine the income of those three people together in, say, that's one household. We would count that as three households unless they're married. That'd be three different, or one claiming independent of the other. We would count that as three households. So we have many more households. We have 2.54 million households. The census only has 2.09 million. And we have fewer people in each household. So we're breaking the census households into smaller pieces. And our numbers actually are consistent with the census numbers. They are almost like identical if you add up the population. There is some confusion about group quarters, which are not included in this average household income. So, but basically, we do a very good crosswalk against the census data. The second confusion is that while the median income is $41,161 overall, nobody is average. Well, no group is average. This is a graph that shows you what the median income. Median income means half or above and half or below, of course. What's the median income? Right between 5 and 6 is the median income for the whole population, $41,161 or $162. That's the median for everybody. But married couples with kids have a median income of $87,126. That means half of married couples with children are in the 9th and 10th deciles. Okay. Whereas single seniors have a median income of $25,000, even if you include all the non-taxable income, so that they are in, their median is in the 4th decile along with other singles. By the way, the seniors are the ones with white hair. Okay. On the diagram. These differ tremendously. So what we're doing in the exercise, we're mixing together these different people. We got oranges and apples because we got single people, young single people, and we got married couples with six kids, and we're saying a household is a household is a household. That should sound familiar to you, right? Household is a household is a household. And yet we know that really isn't true, and it's really hard to know how to adjust for that. This diagram from page 69 of the study shows the mix by decile of different kinds of households. And what you notice on there is just simply that the singles who aren't seniors are concentrated in the bottom deciles much more. The singles who are seniors also, the black area there. Deciles 1 and 2, 75% of the people in the first two deciles are single, but only 11% in the top two deciles are single. So the singles are concentrated toward the bottom, not unexpectedly. The first two deciles 1 and 2, have 21% of those people have children. But in 9 and 10, it's 50% are families with children. Again, in bottom decile, most of the families with children, of course, are single-parent families, which is the second to bottom row there. So again, we've always had some difficulty. We've never really gotten called to task on this quite as much as I would expect to be from lumping everybody together. Now, there are various ways to adjust for this. Some studies take the household size and divide by the square root of the number of people in the household. And we toyed with that, but I wasn't sure I wanted to come to tax committee and say, well, the household income is total income divided by the square root of the number of people in the household. I wasn't quite sure how it was going to go across with the general public to be defining income as something divided by the square root of something. So we haven't done that. What we have tried to do is we have gone in and we have shown some tables that are limited to a single household type. In Chapter 5 of the study, there are tables limited just to married couples or just to single people or just to seniors. And we take the whole population. There are 505,000 married couples with children. So let's just look at them. Divide them into 10 groups. Deciles of married families with children. And then look at what that does. And of course, the median then, the middle is going to be between 5 and 6 deciles, is going to be that 87,000. And you get a much better feel. If you want to look for representative households, you want to look what is a typical married couple with kids, those tables in Chapter 5 are the place to look. What's a typical single person without kids? Those tables give you a lot of information about individual types of households, and I think it's a much better answer to trying to deal with the problem of apples and oranges here than trying to come up with some way to merge or to pull together different households by adjusting income somehow and moving them around. But I really would encourage you to look at Chapter 5. Chapter 5 has a lot of information. It is buried in the back of this report. Nobody ever much sees it. Whenever I show it to people, they say, wow, that's neat. So again, take a look at Chapter 5, those tables 5-1, 5-2, 5-3, 5-4, 5-5. They give you how many children they have on average in that decile, how much their wages are, what their home value is on average, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a lot of information about households of a particular type. The third warning, or the third problem here, is business tax incidence. And this is just a warning because we have a real problem applying the incidence study to changes in business taxes. There's a tendency to want to look in the incidence study and say, oh, the corporate tax is distributed, the burden distributed this way in the study, so if we change the corporate tax, that's how the change will be distributed. And that just isn't true. a change in taxes is going to be distributed, the burden is going to be distributed differently than the existing taxes are on average. We talk about average incidence and incremental incidence. The study assumes that all states impose tax simultaneously, so every state is imposing their taxes, and then we look at where we are relative to other states. And if we're sort of at the average of other states, that's different than if we stick out as having a higher rate than other states. The portion of the tax that's above average in other states is going to have a different burden on Minnesotans. It's going to be distributed differently. Business is going to react differently to a tax that is higher than the national average than just to the average. And so we divide these taxes into the average tax on national capital, the average sector differential, manufacturing versus some other sectors, and then a Minnesota differential, which is how much higher we are than the national average if we're higher. What happens is that an incremental incidence for a change in tax will differ from the average incidence because all of that change is going to be incremental. It's all going to be the Minnesota differential. It's going to change the Minnesota differential. And so it's going to be distributed differently. Think about a glass of water. I won't put a glass up here for fear of breaking it. But if you fill a glass of water and you fill it up toward the top and you say, well, that looks fine. What if I add more water to it? Will it stay where that water was? Well, no. If you pour more water in, it's going to be distributed differently. Well, the same thing is true with business taxes. When you change the level of the tax, you're going to have a different distributional impact, different effect on wages versus consumers versus profits than for the average. So don't ever use the results of this study on business taxes. When we did the analysis of the three bills, we actually are using incremental analysis as we should be. The next page shows the difference between the two, sort of roughly. We don't do incremental analysis with any great deal of detail in the study, but this is from the page 62 of the study. And if you're interested in the differences between these, I urge you to take a look at those pages. Finally, should we use, or almost finally, should we use 2008 or 2013? 2013 is what would occur under current law in 2013. I don't think anybody believes we're going to be in 2013 with current law. So there is some problem with looking at 2013. This shows the difference. There's not a whole bunch of difference between 2013 and 2008. Our projections are, there's a lot of uncertainty about where we're going to be in 2013, but our projections simply are fairly simplistic projections out to 2013. It does take law changes into account. You'll notice that the red line, which is 2008. The blue line on the screen, the lower line, looks like the lower line most of the way, is 2013. Taxes are dropping at the lower end. They're actually a little bit higher at the top end. The 2013 is a little higher in the 8th, 9th, and 10th deciles. And as a result, the Suits Index is getting a little bit closer to zero, a little less regressive overall. What's driving this? Well, it's hard to know what's driving it. The one thing that really stands out when you look at these results is that state taxes between 08 and 13 are going down. The average state tax, average effective tax rate for all Minnesotans in 2008 is 8.2%. By 2013, it'll be 8.0%. So average state taxes are going down, but that's completely offset under current law by the increase in local taxes from 3.3% to 3.5% of income. Both taxes are changing their regressivity. The state tax in slide 24 is becoming, it's dropping a lot at the bottom and not much at the top. That's because the income tax is keeping up with growth. The sales tax is not. The regressive taxes don't. So through time, the state taxes are getting more progressive. They actually end up being progressive with a plus 0.09 Suits instead of slightly regressive in 2008. So the big change is state and local taxes. You can't really explain what's going on with the Suits Index or regressivity with this, though. This is a long-term trend. This is the local share of tax collection. This is not burden. This is tax collections from 1990 through 2013 in all the studies that we've got. And what you notice is that the local share of taxes dropped quite a bit in 98 and 2000 because state taxes were going up, going gangbusters with capital gains and the economy was booming. You remember back to those days. And they dropped even more in 2002, which, of course, was the Ventura reform. I shouldn't say refer. The legislature's reform of property taxes. But it was that reform that took over a lot of school taxes. The state took over some of that burden. It dropped down to 24.6%. We are now in 2008, and certainly in 2013 in the current law, we're back to where we were in the early 90s. So the share of sales of local taxes has gone up quite a bit. It had been very low after those reforms. It's now back up to where it had been earlier. Longer term, we can see trends too. But on the other hand, you can't explain what's going on with the Suits Index or regressivity with this change. It's because it's going up, and yet the Suits Index is getting less regressive. So between 8 and 13. So the problem with this is it's so hard to figure out how to explain why things are changing historically. There's so much going on at one time. I'm going to skip the slides on the income tax, income deciles, unless somebody has a question on them later. Just want to say a word about the history. Slide 29 shows the history of effective tax rates by year. You'll see that they were high in the early 90s. They are now lower than they were then. They're a little higher than they were in 2002. You can look at average effective tax rates. This is the total tax burden on Minnesota residents divided by total income Minnesota residents. And this is the suits index history. We said that one of the advantages of this report is you have a history. Well, that's an advantage and a disadvantage. And the disadvantage is that you're asked to explain the history. This is the suits index. There are two suits indexes shown here. The white ones are the historical ones. They are a simpler measure of suits index, not as accurate, but we have the historical numbers for those. The blue are the numbers reported in the report this year and starting in 2004, which are a better measure of the suits index. It's just more complicated to estimate it. So for the comparison purposes, look at the white here. But the white, I mean, you see a lot of bouncing. What happened in 98? Suddenly the tax system was a lot more regressive in 98. What did that? I can't see any tax policy doing that very much. That wasn't tax policy. And what happened between 2004 and 2006? If you look for tax policy to drive that, you can't find many tax policy drivers between 4 and 6 that did that. And so it's very tough historically to look. It's easy to sort of say if you change tax policy, you will have an effect. But to try to explain the historical trends here, it's clearly a downward trend. The suits index is getting more negative through time. But it's bouncing around a lot, too. And the question would be why, and we've been unsuccessful in explaining much of that. The one explanation we come up with that is intriguing is that it's the economy, stupid. The economy is changing a lot. A lot of the change in the suits index seems to be related to changes in the distribution of income through time. 1998, the share of the top 5% of the income distribution went way up in 98, stayed up in 2000, then dropped in 2002. Well, if you look back at the earlier slide, what happened is the opposite. The suits index went way down in 98, stayed pretty low in 2000, went back up in 2002. Whoops. And then if you look, it went way up back and up in 2006 when the suits index again became more regressive. If you do a simple correlation between the suits index and the share of the top 1% of the share of income earned by the top 1% in the state, you get a simple correlation of about 0.86. That suggests that the distribution of income can explain a considerable share of changes in the distribution of income can explain a considerable share of the changes in the suits index. It's not to say tax policy doesn't matter, because it obviously does, but it takes a lot of tax policy to make these kind of swings, so something else is going on here as well. And with that, I'll end. I do have some, if someone wants to know how big a change it takes to change suits indexes, I have some slides that can talk about how big 0.06 is, but you don't have them in your packet, so I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wilson. As I said before, we'll go right into Professor Spry and then some more comments from Dr. Wilson. Then we'll open it up for questions from members. Welcome the committee, Professor Spry. We're very happy to have you here today. If you could please make your presentation, sir.
Sure.
Representative Brukovina.
I'm just curious. Do you have anybody else that you've asked in that's a professor of economics or whatever, like Mr. Spry? I mean, why do we have Mr. Spry in front of the tax committee on this, and we don't have Representative Bills, who's an economics teacher, and he can get up there and say the same thing?
Because he's such a nice guy, pretty much.
Well, I haven't seen that in him yet, I will today.
Representative Rukovina, we have Professor Spry here. He approached us, and just so everyone knows, we have opened it up for other professors to be invited or doctors of economics or whatever, and we didn't have anybody come forward. So what I'd like to do is go into Mr. Spry's presentation, then back to Dr. Wilson, and we'll open it up for questions to members. Representative Rukovina.
Mr. Chair, just so you know, I have a doctor's degree in life and on taxes. So.
You'll have plenty of time to present. And Dr. Wilson, Dr. Wilson, you had mentioned something about this might be too complicated for us or something. Please remember, this is the tax committee where every member is above average, except me. So, Dr. Wilson.
I meant no offense, Mr. Chair.
Oh, no, just we're all above average here. Professor.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Spry. I'm a private citizen from Representative Paymar's district in St. Paul, and so the views and errors I may make are mine alone. And I wanted to make a few comments on the use and what I believe is sometimes the misquoting or misuse of the tax instance study. And so in looking at any tax instance study, it's very important that you understand what question is being asked, and maybe there are other questions that people may care about that aren't being asked. So as Dr. Wilson said, what the tax instance study is reporting is the slice of state and local taxes collected by Minnesota from Minnesota residents and its localities from the point of view of Minnesota based on a one-year snapshot in time. And so some of the questions that are not completely answered by the tax instance study include Vice Chair Loon's question, who pays the taxes that my constituents pay, that Minnesotans pay? And that's because the tax instance study currently omits federal tax payments. And just as Dr. Wilson said, about 16% of Minnesota's state and local taxes are exported to non-Minnesota residents. You might think that a similar percentage, it could be a little bit different, of other states' taxes are borne by Minnesota residents, and that there's some concern I would have that, especially if those tend to be taxes on business savings and investment, those might disproportionately be in some of the top deciles. I want to caution you, the tax instance study, because of this, doesn't answer who pays the total state and local tax burden on Minnesotans, because it has the part that Minnesota collects, but not the part that other states collect that's a burden on your constituents. And finally, you might be interested in a question of who pays the taxes that finance Minnesota state and local government spending. And the tax instance study includes just about all, 99% plus, of the taxes that Minnesota and the Department of Revenue and local counties may collect. However, about 20% of your spending is general fund spending, where in essence you might think about it as using the IRS as an accountant to split the check with the other 49 states. And that actually, I believe, is a source of strong progressivity in the general tax system. And another comment I have, this is not unique to the Minnesota study. This is something I think economists would like to do, but I personally am just not good enough to do. And that is the tax instance study distributes the tax burden of dollars collected in taxes, but you may remember discussions of deadweight loss or the excess burden, the inefficiency caused by taxes, and generally that is not included or distributed to different income groups. So I have a number of quotes. They're very bipartisan. Former tax chair Krenke made this, what I believe is the same type of slight misstatement that Governor Dayton has made, which is to refer to the tax instance study as, in the words of a former Representative Krenke, referring to total state and local tax burden on households by income range. And I just would caution you, if you're saying total, you're omitting some tax burden, and that may tend to be, again, other states' taxes, particularly on capital. And then finally, the executive director of Minnesota 2020, not even really qualifying by saying Minnesota, but saying things that Minnesota's highest income earners pay a lower percentage of their income and taxes than 90% of Minnesotans pay. And I just try to be really careful and accurate in what you say. And you really need to qualify what you're referring to and what's being omitted. And part of that, you can see, one thing I don't believe the tax committee has regularly seen is some of the work by the Congressional Budget Office and other researchers on federal tax rates. This is the most recent Congressional Budget Office data I can find. This is only federal taxes. It's not from a state perspective. It's a national perspective. And if you want progressivity, my training and reading of the literature is the best tool for progressivity is shown in red, which is the federal individual income tax. Among other things, it sort of sidesteps any interstate mobility issues because you get to impose the tax on Minnesota and South Dakota and Florida and Texas and California. So because of refundable tax credits, especially the earned income tax credit, you can see what would be the first four income deciles or the first two income population quintiles are negative, but there's also payroll taxes. So even at the federal level, there are these differences in progressivity, and the federal personal income tax is particularly good at delivering progressivity, while the payroll taxes, some of the excise taxes, sort of everything else put together, a little bit less so. The Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, I believe, is a pretty trustworthy source of information. They have a little bit more recent data, which is 2009. And but as you remember, 2009 was a lousy year. That was the recession. Also, there were some tax law changes. So here you can see in the first quintile, the federal individual income tax rate, on average, negative 10.2. If you want to really shape the distribution of income, again, I think this shows federal individual income tax policy is really the most effective tool. And in part because the federal income tax was so low in the first quintile, and this is probably a one-time occurrence in 2009 because of the recession and some policy changes, you actually have a negative 0.9, just under 1% negative average tax rate in the first quintile. And as you move up to the fifth quintile, and I also broke out 95 to 99 and the top 1%, you can see the federal progressivity is especially driven by the federal income tax. I've had a lot of questions from members about, well, what if you tried to combine things? And this is hard. This is hard to combine because the federal methodology usually uses an adjustment for household size, Dr. Wilson talks about, and Minnesota doesn't. We're above average in income. So I found two sources, and again, especially with these federal numbers, I would put a plus minus here. Don't think these are gospel. The next two slides, I think, are suggestive. But this is Professor Casey Mulligan in the New York Times. And what we see in blue is every tax, state and local, and all the other federal taxes, especially a lot of dollars of payroll tax, except the federal personal income tax. And that is not that different than what you see in the tax incidence study, which is sort of flat with a dip in the 10th decile. Now, the dark line the dark line is combining, and again, the red on the right part, that's positive tax payments, and on the left, for like especially the first and second decile, that red is actually negative. Another way to see this, although this is now a little bit old, the Tax Foundation did a study where they tried and they also did spending incidence, which I think is pretty problematic and just hard to do. But they looked, and this again is a little different point of view than the view of a state. This is a national view of state and local taxes and then federal taxes. And again, it's the federal taxes that can really deliver progressivity. And if you look at state and local taxes, this isn't all that dissimilar to the tax incidence study. Again, there's a slight dip in their result, and they're doing quintiles at the top 20%. There's a lot of discussion about the federal taxes. And my view is that the federal, state, and local tax systems are interconnected. In part, you share tax bases. So I believe your tax collections from the personal and corporate tax would be a lot higher without the federal taxes. And again, I like this analogy. It's sort of like being on a double date with the IRS. You are putting straws into the tax bases of like a milkshake on a double date. The IRS is putting a lot of straws into your tax base. So what the tax base can generate for you as a state is probably substantially different because of the federal taxes that you share. Usually about 20% of the spending in the Minnesota state budget is financed by federal revenue. And the way I think about this is that you're going out for a meal or to a tavern with 49 of your other friends, and you have 50 people. And the question is, at the end of the night, do you pay 1/50th of the bill if you agree to split the bill, or do you pay 1/2500th of the bill, which is your share of what you consume when you go out and agree to split the check? So I would argue that this is actually a very good way to bring progressivity into state government, is to use the progressive federal income tax to collect taxes and then fund spending. And there's a general longstanding tradition in economics going back to Richard Musgrave, who was one of the founders of public finance, that for distributional issues, the federal government is the best level to set policy. Also, in terms of what you control federal tax policy in a way that you may not appreciate. The federal government would be collecting no alcohol taxes if state legislatures had not allowed the sale of alcohol by constitutional amendment. The federal government would be unable to collect corporate or personal income taxes without the affirmative votes of state legislatures to pass constitutional amendments. So in our federal system, state legislatures have important control over the tax instruments. And this brings me to one of my favorite things to point out, which is Minnesota has about 0.08 of a percent of world population, about 2% of U.S. population, and 0.33% of world GDP. So when you're thinking about tax policy at a state level, I think you should think of Minnesota in many ways as a small open economy. And that means that because of mobility, you don't need, and I think it's important to just briefly talk through the model, because skilled labor is likely to be at least somewhat mobile or relatively mobile. When you think about changes, especially in personal income tax policy, you should realize you don't need everybody to move. You need enough people, and people move frequently, enough people to move so that gross wages adjust to equalize utility through the adjustment of gross wages.
Professor Sprite, yeah. You could speed her up a little bit here.
So, two more slides. One thing that the tax system study does very well is it cautions about some of the issues of using annual instance only. I'd prefer if, and this is more work, and this is actually fairly challenging, is if you saw results by annual instance, maybe an average over a few years, and lifetime incidence. Because, for example, on the sales tax, which is about 22% of your revenue, the suits index is about -2.2 for annual incidence. And for lifetime incidence, the sales tax is very close to proportional for a suits index of near zero. And so that's a big difference in how you think about sales taxes. And that's in part because people's income each year bounces around and varies. It also varies over the life cycle compared to consumption, which is more smooth. So in conclusion, I think the tax incentive study generally has a strong national reputation at economic conferences in answering a very specific question. There are some other things that it doesn't answer, so I would urge you to be very careful and specific when you refer to the tax incentive study. You may want to say this is referring to annual incentives, not an average of a few years, and very specifically making sure your audience understands what taxes or dollars Minnesota spends are not included in the study. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Professor Spry. Dr. Wilson, any closing thoughts before going to questions?
I appreciate Professor Spry's comments. He is a well-trained economist. He's also a good friend of mine. We've worked closely over the past summer and fall on a project that was mandated by this committee, among others, mandated by the legislature for a review of tax expenditure, how to bring tax expenditures into the budget process. He and five other colleagues, economists from around the state, worked on that, came up with unanimous recommendations. It was just published in the most recent edition of State Tax Notes. It's getting some national play. I would urge you to pay attention to Professor Spry's work on that study as well. Let me just reply pretty briefly to particularly his recommendations on his last slide. Directions for improvements. Don't misuse the Minnesota Tax Incentive Study. I'm all for that one. The difficulty, of course, is that when you put out a lot of statistics, you know the old book that's called Lies, Damn Lies, and Statistics. Well, the problem is when you put out a lot of statistics, they can be used, and you are all masters of using statistics for your purposes. And there's very little way that we can do too much to keep that from happening. But I do think he's correct. I do think the three examples he have of misuse on his second or third slide, misuse, Representative Krenke would get a chuckle, I think, from his inclusion on this list. But I think those may be a little bit more, I'm not sure to the extent to which those are misuse, which those are oversights. And you almost need a bigger context. Every sentence can't say state and local or Minnesota state and local. But he's right. I mean, you ought to always make it clear that it's Minnesota state and local taxes. That's all it's talking about. Certainly that it does not include federal. I think putting Minnesotan is not nearly as important as making it clear that it's not federal. In terms of his other recommendations, include federal and other states' taxes in the future. That's in your omnibus bill. That is something that we are not, we know is a lot of trouble. We're not opposed to it. I don't know how much usefulness it will get. You will show that the overall system is going to end up being progressive. But it's still not clear to me when the issue in front of you is how to finance Minnesota government. It doesn't seem to me that by itself gets you all that far. I think in some ways Professor Spry is more on target when he talks about how progressive the structure should be, that mobility and other issues mean that you may have difficulty getting using the Minnesota tax structure, making it more progressive or less regressive for reasons of competition with other states. I think it's just a little harder to argue for regressivity, I guess, than it is to say, we'll throw the federal taxes in there and it's progressive. But your real question is how to finance Minnesota state and local government. So I think those are the taxes you have control over. I think this notion that 20% of your budget is paid for by federal money is somewhat of a red herring, because if you don't take that money, your taxes go down by only 2% of that. It's not a case of you. Minnesotans don't pay for the money that comes in from the feds. The money we pay goes to Mississippi and other states as well. So in some sense, trying to bring that into the analysis by itself. But including federal taxes overall, I think it does provide additional information. It's difficult to do. We have put a fiscal note in. It will increase the cost of study by about 50%. So you're talking about significant impact in a in hard budget times. The third suggestion, report using annual income, average income for some years, and lifetime income is much more problematic. First of all, I don't know how to measure lifetime income. I don't know how we would even do it in terms of this kind of study. The people who even done average income over several years are looking only at income tax for the tax men. They're looking at income tax revenue, income tax income, and they don't have non-filers in at all. We have to have non-filers in. We have to estimate sales taxes. You'd have to have multiple years of sales tax estimates as well as multiple years of income. Having a panel data set like that that goes through time is a really good idea, but it's very tough because people get married, they get divorced, they leave the state, and so the tracking of things is very difficult. You'll notice the feds have done this twice for income tax. They've done it twice in recent years, for a 10-year part cycle, but I don't know of any state that does panels like that because it is very difficult. So even doing multiple years would be much more difficult, I think, at the state level. By the way, lifetime income is an interesting concept when people don't live here all their life. So you got a lot of people moving in, a lot of people moving out, so I'm not quite sure what lifetime income is for people who come in and leave the state. I think there are other ways to deal with it. I think our use of our breaking into different household types is one way. Disregarding the first decile is another way of our dealing with the problem of incomes that bounce around. The lifetime issues, I think, are dealt with better by looking at family types instead of trying to do it with some big panel. Report resulting with, last thing he says, report results using finer age categories. The biggest problem there is not that we don't know ages, because we know ages for most people in this sample. But trying to do all the consumption tax, all the where we have to assign a tax burden, trying to do that by age. We have a very small consumer expenditure survey sample at the national level. We're already slicing it into 9 family types and doing estimates for each of the 9 family types by income. It's a statistical process that is already pushing the limits of what the data can tell us. And to add age into that mix, I think maybe slicing and dicing this data set that we have to work from in more ways, finer than we can do it. We just get too far. And there's just limits to what we can do. I think that's a bigger problem with doing the age than anything else. It's just I don't know that we could do it for the consumption taxes at all. I think otherwise we'd have less trouble with it. So overall, I appreciate Professor Spry's comments. And again, he understands what's in the incident study very well, and certainly is speaking from with more knowledge about some issues at the federal level than I have.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. We'll now go to member questions. I have Runbeck, Loon, and Kiffmeyer. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Wilson. Gosh, really incredible stuff to think about here. I found it so interesting. You said it takes a lot of tax policy to swing the suits index to progressivity, which do we know? I mean, we don't know apparently. Then, if the tax rate that the governor's proposing would give us, you know, sort of this ideal progressivity, it sounds like to me. And, you know, if that isn't going to do it, how much, you know, would you base a tax policy on this study alone, which is what he's doing? It seems to me that it's fraught with all kinds of problems. But please comment on whether, you know, what it would take in Minnesota to get to this flat progressivity, flat index.
Dr. Wilson.
Chair, Representative Runbeck, I put a slide up here, which I guess is on the screen now, yeah, which I didn't, which is not in your handout, but the bottom line there. We have done that analysis of the governor's budget and his income tax change, the fourth tax bracket, in his supplemental budget, not his original budget, but supplemental budget. Would raise the suits index by 0.022, so it would take it to minus 0.025. So this is with population suits; that's all we can do. But so it moves it. It moves slightly more than halfway.
Yeah.
But it doesn't go the entire distance for sure. I would say that there is nothing in the incident study, and I tell reporters this all the time. The incident study does not suggest that a flat line, perfectly proportional income proportional tax system is the ideal. The incident study does not suggest that as an ideal. That's a question for you. I think it's important to know what the facts are. So many of the taxes that you collect are hidden taxes. The business taxes are hidden. Even the consumer portion of the insurance premiums tax is hidden. A lot of these taxes are hidden. Nobody knows really who pays them. I think there's a tremendous advantage to knowing what the burden really is of these taxes. So, I mean, I think the information is really useful, but to then go to the next step and say, well, it ought to be perfectly horizontal, that's a value judgment. The governor strongly believes that, but that certainly is a value judgment. And his proposal gets you a long way there. It could be that, if the cycle of inequality or the change in inequality of driving things, maybe that would be enough a few years down the road to get us back almost to a zero, but it certainly doesn't do it in 2013 under the projections.
Representative Runbeck?
Mr. Chair, just one more question. I think the household data, too, is terribly troubling. You commented on the first decile. I suspect, then, there are a lot of students in that decile, obviously, with the single not seniors and so on. Could you comment on the 10th decile? If you've got, a married couple with three adult children,
wasn't sure how
is that four households? And how does that factor into the 10th decile?
Dr. Wilson.
Chair, Representative Runbeck. The household is defined, think of a household as sort of who would file an income tax return together.
Right.
So it's the two taxpayers, if you're married, it's the taxpayer and spouse and any dependent children. So if the students are dependents, they are in. We pull them into their parents' household, and they're part of that household. So a student working part time is earning income, but that income is included in the household's income with the parents. It's not, in fact, it's counted as separate. So the single people we're talking about have to be not dependents on somebody else.
Yeah.
You do still have a lot of grad students. You've got the medical students in there to some extent. And one way to have mobility is to graduate from medical school. And you'll jump. So at the top, if you have a family with three kids and they're dependents, they're all going to be one household.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Wilson, I mean, that's no surprise. We've known that for such a long time that families where more people are working, households where more family people are working, are clearly those with the most income and are going to be at the top decile. So it just seems so strange that we're going to be sort of aiming here to punish those kinds of households. With our tax policy. But thanks.
Okay, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for either Dr. Wilson or Dr. Spry. And maybe a little bit of a takeoff on Representative Runbeck's question, but my question is about mobility between the deciles. And I think, Dr. Spry, you talked about that a little bit as well. Whether we have any good studies that kind of measure over time people's movement among these deciles, because again, I would assume as people are maybe in school or just starting their first job and that are going to be in the lower deciles, will probably be moving up. And do our tax policies do a good job at looking at the different sort of financial obligations and pressures on taxpayers in the different phases of their lives within the decile, like the little picture of the family with two kids? People presumably have a mortgage, may have college costs and that, where somebody who's retired may have their house paid for. They've got property taxes, obviously, but they're not carrying that monthly mortgage payment anymore. How does that factor into what we're looking at here?
Professor Spry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I think we now, if we can make it full screen so you can see the numbers.
Professor Spry, do we have that in your packet, or where is that coming from?
Yes, this is two of the last slides on the handout of slides, I believe, if you go all the way to the end.
Okay. Thank you, Professor. To the Loon question?
Yeah, so to your question, Representative Loon, there's a lot of income mobility. In fact, a lot of income mobility occurs when people retire. So I believe the last time I was here, I left an article called Income Mobility in the United States, New Evidence from Income Tax Data. And this is from two economists published in the National Tax Journal that worked for the Treasury Department. And by working in Treasury, they could produce a table that shows the amount of mobility over a 10-year period. And so if this is addressing your question, first, if you go and look at the 96 income quintile, and I'm going to first take you to the middle, and if you read across horizontally, that third line that says middle, and you start maybe in the middle at 31.8, 31.8% of households that were in the middle income quintile in 1996 stayed there in 2005. 15% moved down to the second income quintile. 32.7% moved up to the fourth income quintile. 5.9% moved down to the bottom. And 14.5% moved into the highest quintile. So that is a fair degree of income mobility. I know there's a lot of discussion of the top 10%. So you see, if we look there, if you take the top 10% in 2005 and then go over to the top 10%, 61.7% of people that were in the top 10% stayed there 10 years later, and that means about 38% moved to a lower group. And similarly, if you took the lowest quintile, the top left, 43.7% from 96 stayed there in 2005, and that means about 57% moved up, but only, if I'm reading this right, 1.9% moved into the top 10% in 2010. So there is income mobility, and this paper has like 2 hours worth of reading on exactly what type of income mobility there is, but it's not like perhaps the NFL, where every year a good team like the Vikings becomes into the bottom quintile of performance, or vice versa. It's more reminding me a little bit of Major League Baseball, where a lot of the teams, unfortunately, like the Yankees, have a tendency, if they're in the top quintile, to somewhat stay there, but there is movement between.
Thank you. And I don't even know if this is a fair comparison or not, but, you know, maybe would you characterize this as a fair degree of mobility between the income deciles? Not so much. And I don't know what we'd compare it to other industrialized countries or.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, one comparison that's done is how has income mobility changed? If you go back to about 85 to 95, and you compare that degree of income mobility to 96 to 2005, relative income mobility has stayed the same. What this study finds is that what you might think of as absolute income mobility has increased, but also income inequality has increased. So I think it's a somewhat complicated issue. Table 4, which may be the last thing, shows absolute income mobility. How much did income go up? And here there's a phenomenon economists might call reversion or regression to the average. And so if you look on the right two columns, this is the average change in income, absolutely adjusting for inflation. And you can see, right, there's a lot of variation. So the mean change for the bottom 20% is an 186% increase in income. But some of that is maybe a fraction that's really moving up, because the median is only 77.2%. Now, if you look at the top, you can see the income absolute change over that 10-year period goes down as you go up. But of course, you're starting, if you're at the top, you're starting at a higher place. So if you're in the top 1% and median income drops 30% over 10 years for the median, you're still pretty high. But there is some degree of mean reversion. It's hard to try to put a number of like a lot or a little, which is why I kind of like the numbers. And that's about the best I have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bloom.
Or I think if Dr. Wilson.
Dr. Wilson, I'm sorry. Dr. Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, I think Professor Spry has done a good job answering. I would say that this is a 10-year period, and this does have the square root of the household size in it, so it's really hard to interpret it from what we would get. But 10 years is a long time, but it doesn't take you into lifetime transitions as much. However, it does get some people into retirement. I would point out, though, that if you look at the top 10% column, the third from the right on this second to last slide in his, a lot of the talk has been on the top 10%. So if the governor's talking about the top 10% a lot, if you look at the top 10% in that column, if you were in the top 1% in the first year, there's an 81% chance you're still going to be in the top 10% 10 years later. If you were in the top 5%, there's a 70.9% chance you're still going to be in the top 10% 10 years later. If you're in the top 10% in the first year, there's still a 60% chance you're still going to be there 10 years later. If you look at the bottom three, that's 60% of the population. The chance of anyone of you in those three deciles, those three quintiles, 60% of the population, the percentage of them that move up into the top 10 is about 3%. So 3% of the bottom 60% are going to move up to the top 10, and a lot of the top 10 is going to stay there. So it is hard to interpret, and I don't want to, I mean, there's a lot of mobility here, so I don't want to downgrade the mobility, but don't overstate the mobility either in terms of the sort of the constancy of people. This also is only income tax filers, and so it doesn't have the non-filers in it, which may be the most non-mobile group in the population.
Representative Loon.
Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Wilson, I'm going to go back to, it's on page 5 of your slide presentation, and it's slide that's labeled number 4, uses broad measures of income. And on the bottom, in this slide, it talks about income in this study includes all money income, and it makes a list there. It says, however, income does not include, and that is in-kind assistance such as food stamps, housing assistance, and medical assistance, and fringe benefits, pre-tax payments, and so on. It seems to me that not including that kind of income, because it is a cost of the state has to pay actual money for somebody to have those food stamps, and if they have the food stamps, it is, if they would have had income to buy that food, we would have included it. But somehow when they get food stamps, we don't. Same thing with housing assistance. If they're paying $300 a month and they're having a subsidized housing situation, that cost of that subsidized housing has an effect. And then fringe benefits as well and pre-tax payments. So I'm just curious if you can just explain, first of all, why did you not include them? Maybe it was legislative. Maybe there were some other reasons that I don't know about it. And the other thing is, it seems to me that, to be fair in regards to all of this, I believe that we actually really should include it. But I would first want to hear from you as to why it wasn't included in the first place, and then any other comments you have.
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer. The decision not to include it goes back to the first study when I was, long before I was here, or not long, but before I was at Revenue. And it was a very conscious decision not to include in-kind, because when most people think about income, they think about cash income. Some of this would be very hard to do. The one thing that would not be so hard to do would be food stamps. Food stamps today are much more like cash than they used to be. It used to be you got many more food stamps than you really wanted to spend on food, and you were sort of forced to consume more food than you wanted to. So the food stamps weren't really worth as much as the cost of them to you. And so you had a hard time putting a value on a food stamp, which really wasn't a dollar of food stamp, but it wasn't worth a dollar. I think today, the way the food stamp program works, a dollar worth of food stamp is generally worth a dollar to the recipient, or at least it often is. And that data is probably more easily available. The others are just about impossible. Housing assistance, we have never been able to get data on housing assistance. A lot of this is federal information. Medical assistance, I don't know how you put a dollar value, because what they're really getting is medical care. You could put an estimate of what the insurance is worth to them, but since they're not buying the insurance, it's not clear what it's worth to them in terms of a willingness to pay kind of thing. Based on their income, it may not be that they would pay much for it because they don't have much income. So putting a dollar value on those is tough. Fringe benefits, the federal, the IRS, the U.S. Treasury and the Congressional Budget Office both include fringe benefits in some of their analysis. Mm-hmm. And they have to estimate them. They're just estimated. They've done a lot of work in that area. fringe benefits are not generally listed on your W-2. We don't have any access to most of that information. If the federal law that requires employer-provided health insurance dollar amounts be placed on the W-2, if that stays in effect, then in a couple of years, we would actually have an estimate of what the value of the fringe benefit for employer-provided health insurance would be. That's going to go mostly to the upper end. That's not something low-income people have. That's something that higher-income people have. It'll move in the opposite direction if we could include it. I think you can make a good case for including in-kind, somehow putting a value on them. I think the difficulty of doing it is extremely high. The other thing that we don't have in here, I mean, the whole health insurance area is the biggest gap, I would say, in this. And it's just beyond our, it seems to me, beyond our ability to come up with a decent way to do that. But we could certainly talk to people at the federal level. I would say there are a couple more things missing, too. Child support payments are not included in income because we cannot get that data because of data privacy reasons. I don't know whether that is something that is literally impossible, but we have always been unsuccessful in getting information to put in the study on child support payments. And that is a problem because we have alimony, but we don't have child support payments. And at the low end, that may be fairly important for some of those families in the lower areas. We also can't get any information from on veterans benefits from the VA. Some of the veterans pensions, disability pensions of various sorts, we don't have in here because they just simply will not share the information with anybody. So some of our lack of information is due to just an unwillingness by the others to, unwillingness or inability to, given federal law, to share the information with us.
Representative Giffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the fact that that may be the case, and I think especially in the beginning, even the use of the word food stamps is an old phrase. We have other words for it now, and there is more specific information. And certainly, since this is a state tax incidence study, the availability of what the state pays for medical assistance in those income categories, not necessarily to the individual, but certainly in our current database situations, I think how much the state pays is generally more of an indicator as far as the value of it. And I would agree with you that some of the other ones on the fringe benefits, I think if you're going to use one, you have to use both. You know, you need to be sure that you include both the in-kind assistance in the first bullet point there and the fringe benefits to make sure that you're reflecting all the deciles in the effect that it may have for you. And I think sometimes, like on the federal level, the estimating of some of those fringe benefits is a little bit more studies out there now than maybe in the beginning. But the other thing is it's also really important that for those of us who read these things to know what is in the underlying assumptions when you do these studies and statistics, what's in and what is not in. Really helps you to effectively, and so for me, it really makes the difference, especially when we're talking about the lower decile, that the in-kind assistance, which is largely that category, has a great deal of that, and it has a bigger impact on their overall income status, and not having that in, I think, somewhat or greatly does affect my interpretation of what I'm seeing here as well. And then the child support, I can understand the veterans benefits and some of those issues, but sometimes there is a statistical analysis that can be done to at least make sure it is included in some way. But I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, I just did want to make just a general comment, though, that I don't know that it's our job to redistribute income. And I thought it was interesting as I read one of your slides in here, mobility limits the effectiveness of state and local redistribution, basically saying that evidence presented in this paper supports a basic theoretical presumption that state and local governments cannot redistribute income. I thought that was a very interesting thing as we have this big discussion about regressive, progressive, and I certainly think that we want to make sure that we analyze these things and the costs of government, what we all do. But I just thought it was a very interesting statement here. And I also thought it was interesting the effect on jobs. A more progressive tax thus induces firms to hire fewer high-skilled employees and to hire more low-skilled employees. And then it goes on to, it says, alters the structure of employment in the state, distorting the mix of labor. It's a long paragraph. I didn't want to take time to read all of that. But I think that it, another statement is states cannot redistribute income for a period of even a few years. So I think this analysis by Feldstein and Roble from the Journal of Public Economics in 1998 is a very interesting comment in regards to what I may see. And one thing is the effectiveness, and the other thing is should we. But if it's not effective, then what's the point of doing so? If it's not effective, then I think that also makes another opportunity. And I appreciate your respect for the fact that the legislature sets a policy and you're here to give us statistical information. It is very valuable, and I appreciate and thank you, Mr. Spry, as well for being here. I found this very worthwhile use of our time just to read through all of these things and your insights. Thank you.
The gentleman from Ramsey, Representative Blesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for both Dr. Spry and Dr. Wilson in relation to the discussion about income mobility. And I missed part of the conversation, so I apologize if you said this already, but if you did, if you could restate it. Can you clarify the data that this study lays out in comparison to historical trends? And do we have anything that approximates the historical trends? For example, I was thinking of our governor, who before he was a senator or anything else, you know, he was the heir to the department store fortune. And he used to say his father was fond of repeating to his kids that you go from wealth to poverty in three generations, and then you can go back again. So watch out for what you have, because you'll lose it in three generations. You all spend it or squander or something like that, which I think he blew most of it on his first Senate race. But I'm wondering. I know, yeah. I don't know how much he has left. He's not spreading the wealth anymore. So how are we now with Dr. Wilson? You were just saying the chances of people moving into that top quartile are very slim, 3%. How does that compare with, say, 50 years ago? What were my chances of getting into the top quartile?
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I just want to, I'll turn this to Professor Spry, but I just want to correct. It's moving into the top 10% was the question, not the 20. Mm-hmm. So 3% chance of those in the bottom 60% moving into the top 10% within sort of 10 years later. So it's a limited time frame as well.
Professor Spry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, one thing I wanted to point out from the study, it's really since the establishment of the panel study of income dynamics that we've had this kind of data, and following that now the Treasury using internal IRS non-public data for income mobility. So I don't believe we have anything going back before maybe 1970. I will drop off the article I cite, and its citation should include some of the beginning literature on this issue. The other thing I just wanted to make clear to the committee is that mobility figure is excluding people that were outside of the 25 to 64 age range. So if you move from being 20 to 30, you're not in that sample. It was deliberately sort of picked with the idea that there are big changes before 25 and after 64. Somewhat related, the one thing I do have historical data that I thought you and I'm sorry, Representative Rukavina is going to miss this, because I thought you would really enjoy this slide, is this is snapshots in time of inequality. And so we have estimate of the income distribution going back to 1970. This isn't mobility, but it's just the snapshot inequality. And what you can see is going from the red in 1970 to the purple in 2006, while the distribution is moved to the right, which is economic growth.
This is adjusting for inflation. You can see the spread in the distribution compared to the red in 1970 to the purple in 2006. Not for Minnesota specifically, but for the U.S. in general. And I think that is an important factor, because the suits index, the way it's calculated, it's not just tax policy. It's the underlying distribution of income. So a thought experiment may help explain this. If everybody was identical, regardless of what taxes you used, you would end up with, a suits index that would be the same. You couldn't change it with tax policy. The reason tax policy can affect the suits index is because there's underlying differences between people, particularly in their patterns of consumption and their income.
Okay. Mr. Chair, so can you tell me then, do I have a better chance now or a worse chance of getting rich than I did 50 years ago?
Depends on whether you buy a lot.
Professor Spry, better or worse?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, because the panel study of income dynamics doesn't go back 50 years, I don't have the data to answer that, unfortunately.
Well, okay, maybe you can answer me this then. Over time, I'm sure you've probably studied other societies, other economies, historical economies, Dr. Wilson or Dr. Spry. Without government policy intervention, tax intervention, or fiscal policy intervention, do those societies tend to grow more diverse with respect to income levels, or more similar? For example, do you end up with a few rich and a few poor, and you end up with people in the middle, or do they tend to stratify and separate out into concentrations of wealth and more poverty?
Professor Spry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, perhaps Dr. Wilson can also take a stab. That's a very broad question. One thing I can say, Nobel Prize winner Dr. Sen, who's originally from India, has observed something. He says there's no recorded famine in a democracy. If you look through the history of the world and you look at famines, massive widespread famine, starvation, functioning democracies. India, once it was a democracy, I believe in 46 or 47, no famine. So that's just an interesting observation. And more generally, I think somewhat across the spectrum, having court systems, having protection for personal property, a lot of the basic functions of government that people across the political spectrum in the U.S. would agree with are extremely important for economic development, perhaps as a necessary condition. And Dr. Wilson?
Anything?
Mr. Chair, I really don't have anything to contribute to that. I do know that if you look at economic development in countries as they develop, most countries as they develop become less equal in early stages of development, so inequality goes up. But there are exceptions to that as well.
Okay.
So I'm not quite sure how to address the question.
Thank you. Well, that's related to my question, and I think as economists, you're typically loath to make specific statements about the direction of a particular economy for fear of influencing people another way. And I understand that, and I remember Alan Greenspan's irrational exuberance comment. And how that got so much, I think that was 1996. Was it? That's right, sir. So, but, you know, it's funny because, after he made that comment, it was picked up on because there was so much negative economic activity afterwards, coincidental or not. But I'm wondering about, say, in the wake of that, in our policy changes, our tax policy changes at the end of the 90s or the beginning of the 2000s, not from a matter of economic policy, but let's just say state fiscal policy. Could we be irrationally exuberant when we refuse to recognize the consequences of fiscal policy and we continue to go down the same road? And when you have a graph, as been suggested, that economic levels tend to diverge, whether it's by that graph or the graph that I passed out in tax committee last night, when you got the top 1% doing extraordinarily well, and then you've got the bottom 90% pretty much stagnant. When I don't have a chance, and I have a dream of, say, getting wealthy and buying that Ferrari that I've always wanted, but there's no chance that I'm ever going to get it, are there any studies that show the impact long-term of how that affects, say, a third quintile or even a seventh quintile worker who says, you know what, forget about it. I'm not going to take that risk. I'm not going to start my own business. Are there any studies that approximate longitudinally income mobility based on inherent risk-taking behaviors?
Professor Sprite, can you have a seventh quintile?
Or just, sorry, did I say quintile?
Yeah.
Decile.
I guess you could have a seventh quintile. It'd be 140%.
Policy, you can have whatever you want.
That's a good point. Professor Spry?
Answer both ways.
Professor Spry?
I don't know, honestly, exactly how to answer Representative Lesch's question, Mr. Chairman, but I would point you to Dr. Terry Fitzgerald at the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, who's one of the leading scholars in the world on income inequality and mobility, and he may be a good source for answers. And he has pointed out household size has shrunk. This is something Dr. Wilson talked about somewhat differently, that there's the median in different categories of households is in different places. And so, again, Dr. Fitzgerald, I guess, agrees with what I was saying, that income inequality has increased. But I would caution you, I think I saw that chart from last night, and when you adjust for household size and for some other factors, Dr. Fitzgerald, you can Google him, he's in the presentation, there still has been at the median real household income growth, although I think your point is correct that the growth has been faster over the last 30 years or so at the top of the income distribution, again, taking the snapshots in time repeatedly over those 30 years.
Representative Blesch?
No more questions.
Okay, I have Mark Hort, Chesky Loeffler, Bills Dabney. Representative Mark Hort.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I have a question for the Chair. Are we going to have another day to talk about the Minnesota tax incident study? I mean, Mr. Chair, I thought the purpose of today's meeting was to talk about and be able to discuss the 2011 Minnesota tax incident study and the tax incident studies done on the governor's tax plan and the House tax plan. We're down to about 5 minutes.
Well, first, Mark, I think we probably should. We'll try and work that in because this, I mean, we've got a lot of questions and we can zoom in more on what you're talking about there, too. So I think we will try to revisit this issue because we've got a lot of members have questions and so forth.
Mr. Chair,
important.
I guess if we're going to have another day, I will hold off on my comments and questions and so forth because that's what I was prepared to do. And, you know, we've relied on, you know, the tax incident study is nonpartisan or consistent historical perspective on tax policy and the economy in Minnesota. And, you know, we're hearing a lot of different views. I'm seeing a lot of different studies that I don't know what side it comes from. You know, I know when I looked at the out-migration studies, there were some that, remember that discussion, that said one thing and some another. I'd like to discuss this nonpartisan document that historically we've been able to look at our past state policy and economy based on that. And, you know, that's what we have control over. The state of Minnesota, this is the Minnesota State Legislative Taxes Committee. I don't see any federal lawmaker here.
I thought we were part of the world court.
Yeah, I know, we're important. But yeah. And so I guess I just, you know, would hope we can come back to this, and then I'll hold off on my comments if we can do that.
The answer would be yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn Chesney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll do the same. I came prepared to discuss the, you know, once every 2 years we get to talk about this report, but I want to, if I may, maybe for next time, and Ms. Bergman, her eagle eye, and she actually brought new copies, but maybe we shouldn't hand them out. The information that you provided in our packet today, which is the governor's incidence report, and in fact, Representative Downey had asked for it repeatedly, and you know, it's too bad he's not here, but he actually wanted to go through the incidence study of the governor's bill. And I was under the impression, too, we were going to talk about, you know, it even came up in the hearing yesterday during the tax bill, you know, when are we going to get to talk about the incidence? And the answer was tomorrow. So we haven't done that yet today.
We talked about some of it.
The governor's? This handout?
Oh, no, not much on that.
So,
well, a little bit.
But what I wanted to, Ms. Bergman found is, just so folks know, this probably should be thrown away. It wasn't, you know, duplicating, they're wonderful, but everyone makes mistakes. It's not copied correctly, and all the important columns at the end of the tables, the last two are all cut off. So that's what you really need to look at to understand it. So I'd advise people to pitch it. The tables look like this, and they're copied where they're all chopped off on almost all the pages. So if you're looking at that, you're not getting the picture, and I think we just need to throw them away and get them copied the landscape way, because we're missing all the actual incidence and burden at the end of the chart and the way it's in the packet. And so, you know, then we don't have to go through repassing that out and talking about that, because we're out of time anyhow. I did, though, before we leave, if I can, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate we're going to come back to it, you know, I did want to mention in just response to what Representative Kiffmeyer said, and she's left, but she took the time to say that, geez, there's this sort of net worth that we're not counting, and why don't we count these things? And then Dr. Wilson walked through why we don't count them. And, you know, I just want to pass, put for the few members who are here, you know, there's a lot of things on other things that aren't counted that if we really want to critique this, then we need to get those in too. And so, an example that, you know, when I see Representative Kiffmeyer, I'll mention it to her in the hall. For example, unrealized capital gains. If you buy a stock for $10, it becomes $100 in value, and you don't sell it, your net worth has changed. And your tax liability, arguably, according to Representative Kiffmeyer, should change, but it doesn't. We don't come in and count that in this report, that your net worth now has gone from $10 to $100 in that stock. So, you know, I think kind of going after the food stamp folks, we need to talk about the folks who don't have to realize their capital gains as we discuss tax incidents. And I think, you know, I think this is the kind of discussion we wanted to have about this report, and also to talk about the thing that, you know, when we were hearing the bill last night, you know, and I said, you know, and that's just my personal opinion, I said, you know, defend this, because I don't think it's defensible what these folks are saying, that the legislature is continually not addressing the problem that we see. But you can see in the governor's incidence report that he absolutely does. So I think that's what some of us wanted to look at, is how he changed that top 10 decile in the 1%, 5%, and that's all cut off, and we didn't discuss it. So
Representative Lencheski, we're going to adjourn the hour, 12 having arrived,
okay.
But what we will do when we come back on the tax incident study and the tax incident study and the governor's proposal to that, I'll be starting with Representative Marquardt, Lencheski, Loeffler, Bills, and Dabney. I'm going to keep this list. Thank you very much, members. Thank you very much, Dr. Wilson and Professor Spry. Very interesting, and we will, this discussion will
thank
continue.
You.
The hour of 12 o'clock having arrived. Good government. Oh, I would just like to announce, please check your emails for future meetings. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.